Welcome to the World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edwin Willems, and this episode's guest, Griffin Barber. Welcome to episode 67, believe it or not, of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I'm your host. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. And this week I have three of my own projects I want to talk to you about before we get into the meat of this episode. Now, the first one, of course, I've mentioned before, but if this is your first time listening, you may not be aware of it. Beginning of this year, March, I kickstarted an anthology featuring some of the authors who were guests on the first year of the podcast. And I asked everybody that year, from that year, and ended up with 18 stories, a mixture of original fiction and reprints. So if you are interested, you can find the ebook version of Shapers of Worlds available everywhere. It features new fiction from Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, L.D. Modisett Jr., D.J. Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, me, Shelley Adina, and reprints by John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie E. Sherneda, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. Among that group of authors, there are Hugo Award winners, Nebula Award winners, British Science Fiction Award winners, Ditmore Award winners, Aurora Award winners, winners of all the major science fiction fantasy awards from around the world, and nominees as well. So please look that up. You can find it, as I said, everywhere. You can also download it directly from Shadowpaw Press. That's my little publishing company that published it. If you go to shadowpawpress.com, you can purchase it directly from there and download it directly from there. There will be a commercial print release. The print version of the book will be out November 17th, at which point you'll be able to order that, of course, online as well, or any bookstore, if they don't have it, will be able to bring it in. So please check that out. Second project of mine to mention is, of course, book three in my own series, World Shapers, which not surprisingly shares the name with this podcast since they started at the same time. Book one was World Shaper, book two, Master of the World, and book three is The Moonlit World. This is the story set in a labyrinth of shaped worlds. My main character, Shauna Keys, is a shaper. She didn't know she was a shaper. Her world in the first book was taken over by the adversary, though, and she discovered she was a shaper with the help of Carl Yatzer, a kind of mysterious stranger who shows up. Book two took place in a world that was shaped by somebody who really, really likes Jules Verne, so it's got all that good stuff in it, airships and weird weapons and floating islands and all that kind of thing. And then book three, which just came out, The Moonlit World, is werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh, my. It's that kind of a world, and my characters, Shauna and Carl, have to navigate this world, find out who shaped it. Shauna's trying to gather the knowledge of all these shaped worlds, called the Hokma, trying to gather that from all of the shapers and carry it to Ygrere, the mysterious woman at the center of this labyrinth of shaped worlds. She's the only one who can save the labyrinth, ultimately, from the adversary who already took over Shauna's world, took it away from her. That's kind of the overarching plot, but my characters, Shauna and Carl, have to somehow find the shaper of this world and not get either eaten by werewolves or turned into werewolves and or vampires. So I had a lot of fun with that, and it's full of my own kind of geeky sense of humor as well. So I think it's funny. Hopefully you do too. And then the third project to mention, a brand new book that, well, not a brand new book, but a brand new release, is called Blue Fire. It just came out in ebook with print to follow eventually. It's written under my pseudonym, E.C. Blake. As E.C. Blake, I wrote a trilogy called The Masks of Agrima, published by Daw Books. My World Shapers books are also published by Daw Books. They're my major publisher. And it was published by a small company that went out of business, and so the rights reverted to me, and so now I've brought it out again under its original title, Blue Fire. They had called it Flames of Nevyana. And as I said, Blue Fire is available now. It's an epic young adult fantasy novel, three young characters from three very different cultures. One of them, in fact, is not entirely human anymore, have to work together in order to save their land from war and destruction and all that kind of stuff. It was a lot of fun to write, and I hope you'll enjoy that one as well if you check it out. So that's Blue Fire by E.C. Blake, available in ebook everywhere, print coming soon. All right, I think that covers the introductory material, except to say that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Now let's get on to this episode's guest, Griffin Barber. Griffin Barber's first novel was 1636, Mission to the Moguls, co-authored with Eric Flint, part of the 1632 series. And of course, Eric was a guest on the World Shapers. Griffin is also the author of the novella Maneater, book 3 of the Murphy's Law series, set in Dr. Charles E. Gannon's Kane Riordan universe. And Chuck Gannon was also a guest on the World Shapers. He's also the author of a number of short stories, Griffin is. His latest novel is Second Chance Angel, co-authored with Casey Azell, who was my guest on just the most recent episode of the World Shapers. And Second Chance Angel was recently released by Blackstone Publishing. Griffin spent his youth in 4 different countries, learning 3 languages and, quote, burning all his bridges. He finally settled in Northern California with a day job as a police officer in a major metropolitan department, where he says he lives the good life with his lovely wife, crazy smart daughter, and needy dog. So, Griffin, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thanks much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. I talked to your co-author on Second Chance Angel, which is one of the books we'll be talking about, Casey Azell, just... 4 days ago, I guess, just the beginning of this week, maybe just 2 days ago. Not that that matters to anybody listening, because this will go live sometime way down the road. But anyway, I did talk to her very recently, and so I've been looking forward to talk to you. And I will start the same way I start all of these, by getting you to go back into the mists of time and tell me how you got interested in science fiction and fantasy, and then in how you got interested in writing it. So how did that all work for you? And a little bit about your, you know, general growing up and background.
So my father was an executive with Caterpillar. And when I started reading voraciously, first off, I'm dyslexic, so I had a lot of challenges to learning to read and learning to read quickly, and especially learning to write manually. And so I think I was a little bit late bloomer when it came to reading a lot of stuff, but I discovered very early on and stole from my father's dresser a copy of The Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
Really got into that and enjoyed it quite a bit, and started reading a lot of science fiction, mostly hard science fiction, though I, you know, specific titles I can't really recall at this late day and age. But until I got into my teens, when I discovered Pornell, Dave Drake, that kind of stuff. So there was the 80s, and, you know, of course, Star Wars, that kind of thing was available as far as media is concerned. But when it came to reading the stuff, I really enjoyed Hammer Slammers and Dave Drake's work. Jerry Pornell's open universe called War World was another one that I just thought the world of. And and C.J. Sherry and a host, Elizabeth Moon, Anne McCaffrey, just a ton of. I remember going to the library and checking out a lot of the Dragon Riders of Pern books as a kid. So, yeah, I had a lot of science fiction influences as a kid.
Did you have friends who were into it as well, or were you kind of the only one that you knew that read this stuff?
No, actually, I kind of lucked out when I was about 10. My one of the kids that moved into my neighborhood from North Carolina was still my friend today. He's working up in Alaska. Kyle moved in, and we discovered that we both like science fiction and fantasy. And he remains a voracious reader and a really good, like, He forwards stuff to me that's, that he thinks I'll enjoy, that kind of stuff. So, but he's more in the fantasy vein these days, as far as reading. So he'll give me, he was the one, I hadn't heard of Lies of Locke Lamora, And he's like, dude. So gave that to me to read, and I really did enjoy it.
Yeah, so, I enjoyed that one a lot too.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a big fan of heist movies. You know, huge fan of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and pretty much everything Guy Ritchie's ever put on film as good examples of the heist or the multiple storylines getting tangled up.
So, where did you grow up? Did you grow up and move around, well, or were you in one place?
Yeah,
or?
We moved around quite a bit. I originally started out, and I was born in Peoria, Illinois, and went to we moved to Spain and then to Canada, and then back to the States when I was, I think, six. And then stayed there until I was 16, at which point we were back in Peoria, Illinois, and then moved from Peoria to Geneva, Switzerland, and stayed there for about 6 years. I finished up my high school there and went to a bit of college, wasting my dad's money, failing out from those colleges back in the States. And went back and was working as a bartender in Geneva at a Mexican restaurant's bar that's right outside the GAR, the train station in Geneva, and met my wife there and returned to the States about a year after that to Nevada, and from thence to California, back to Chicago. Which is probably one of my favorite cities in the world. And from Chicago, Oak Park, outside of Chicago, and then off to Northern California, which is where I've stayed for the last, 22 years now.
You did a lot of things in there, but you ended up as a police officer. I see from your bio.
Yeah, that's, yep. So I joined the Major Metropolitan Department here in Northern California and been doing that for 20 years. As of February last year.
Where did the writing fit in with all of that? When did you really start trying your hand at it? Was that as a kid or later on?
I wrote a bit as a kid, got into a contest and won the local one, won the next one, level up, the next tier. And then they didn't believe I'd written it myself. So they basically said I wasn't, they disqualified me. And I showed them I didn't write again for, 20 years.
Oh, that taught them.
Yeah, exactly. So then but in the meantime, I did a lot of role-playing games. I ran a lot of D&D and Role Masters, Space Master, Traveler, pretty much every kind of role-playing game out there, pen and paper role-playing game out there. I usually read it, liked it, and ran it.
I like to say that although theoretically I majored in journalism at Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas, really I majored in Dungeons and Dragons and minored in everything else.
Right.
Based on the amount of time.
It probably taught you more about stats than the stats class, right?
It probably did, yeah. So what was kind of, when you got back into trying to write, what did you start with? And how did that work? You getting into getting published professionally?
So I was walking a beat, and on my beat was Borderlands Bookstore.
Oh, yes.
Which is one of the premier Northern California bookstores, certainly for science fiction and horror. Hanging out with Alan Beats, and I'd been talking about how I'd always wanted to write and was trying to finally write because I had a couple things going on as well. So attention deficit disorder is a real thing. And I kind of resent people when they talk about, oh, I just got the ADD or whatever ADD moment. I was diagnosed with it and finally got some medication for it after I was sitting on the counselor's couch and going and blubbering about how I wanted to do all these things and never had. She said, well, you know, there's some medication you could probably take and you could, you know, maybe do that. And a year after that, I had my first novel written. And so I'm walking the beat and I'm talking to different folks at the Borderlands and stuff, and I was told by Alan Beats, the owner there, you know, hey, take a look at this. Or he said, let me take a look at it and I'll tell you what I think. And I was like, well, sure. So thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. And he did. And he said, this is really good. And you ought to send it out. And he was also really relieved that his beat officer actually wrote well rather than crappily and he'd have to let me down easy given that I was going to be around for a while. So that novel has been since trunked, but a lot of the work I did on it informed Second Chance Angel. I've always been kind of fascinated with AI and how do we get like an anthropomorphic AI that, you know, feels and talks and seems to behave more in line with humanity without having the, you know, natural instinct for survival, et cetera. So that dealt with that, but there were some other errors and problems with it. So it got trunked.
Well, you learn to do by doing, as they say. So when did you,
exactly, especially in writing,
when did you make the step up to the next level then?
So, I'd been going to, as an adjunct to trying to sell, that novel, I'd been going to World Fantasy cause it was really cool. And that's where my friend Kyle met, Scott Lynch and I'm like, who? And he's like, no, it's Scott Lynch. He's the Lieslach Lamour. You got to read it. It's an awesome book. So anyway, I'd been going to that for some time and hobnobbing with a lot of these authors that are really neat people. We attended a panel with Walter John Williams and Charles Gannon, Chuck Gannon, and it was on gunpowder and fantasy, I think. And the panel went really well, but there was an individual at the panel who was a little bit abrasive, and Chuck was being hunted by this guy, and Kyle and I kind of intervened to make sure that this guy didn't harass Chuck much because we wanted to talk to him. And we ended up speaking with Chuck and having a few cocktails at the bar that evening. And the next morning he's all, hey, I read some of your stuff off your blog and it's really good. It's got a very different quality. You need to write for Eric Flint's 1632 universe. And, I was, the Grantville Gazette was specifically what he was talking about. It was, you know, it's a good way to get short stories out there, get your name recognized and work with professionals, get the professional credits, et cetera. And it still remains that. But at the time I was, you know, like I said earlier about how I can show people, you know, I know better because I'll not show, you know, I'm not right. I was like, oh, you know, I'm not a big fan of time travel, number one. Number two, I'm not I've got this novel I'm trying to sell. So he let it go and let me, but a year later when I come back to him, to World Fantasy, he's like, how's that going for you? So I kind of bit my, swallowed my pride and said, it's not going well. And we haven't sold it. And he's like, oh, they still need people that can tell some stories and synthesize all the history and stuff. And I think you'd be good at it. So I wrote a story, and unlike, you know, it's an unusual in my experience of talking to other authors. That story that I wrote, Bank on It, sold.
I've had Eric on the program.
Immediately.
Both Eric and Chuck have been on the World Shapers, so I've talked to both of them. And we talked, of course, about the 1632.
Yeah.
The 1632 universe. So a lot of authors have kind of made their way in through that particular universe, it seems like.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of words being written for it. I don't know how many it's up to now. I think it might be 6 or 7 million. There's a lot of words and a lot of different collaborators, and it's a really neat universe, and I enjoy writing in it. It's the rigor of trying to get historical fact and characters right. Combined with being a little creative with what if, you know, that game that we all played as kids, you know, what if somebody went back and killed Hitler, and when, that kind of stuff. So it's been fun.
Now, we're going to talk about Second Chance Angel in a little bit, but just to get an idea of your creative process, we'll take a look at the Maneater, I guess, is the latest one. The whole series is called
Murphy's Lawless.
Murphy's Lawless. Yeah, I was just quick. I know what that is. Yeah, and it's actually set in the Kane Riordan universe.
Yes.
So again, which is Chuck Gannon's.
Yeah, which is Chuck Gannon's universe. I joke that I call Chuck. It's Chuck the Rainmaker Gannon, because a lot of the opportunities I've had, indeed most of the opportunities I've had, aside from Second Chance Angel, although he did introduce me to my agent. Everything that has kind of come to me that's been super positive has been through Chuck Gannon. I have a lot. I owe him a lot.
Well, maybe give us an overview of Murphy's Lawless and Maneater specifically, whatever you want to give by way of a synopsis without, giving anything away that you don't want to give away.
So in the core books of Chuck's universe, the Kane Riordan books, he is basically behind enemy lines, and one of the things in his galaxy spanning war, or our neck of the galaxy anyway, one of the ongoing deals is that this alien race has been kidnapping human soldiers and turning them out for their use. And Kane Riordan has stumbled across a group of those soldiers that they're put in cryo sleep for however long, in some cases hundreds of years, and then thawed out when they felt it appropriate. But Kane stumbles across a unit of these folks, or a group of soldiers stolen out of time, and he puts them to use, but for their own good kind of situation. So it's a very much one of those tropes of soldiers out of time kind of deal. Murphy's Lawless is dealing with some of the guys that are a little bit more broken and perhaps not as suitable for frontline action, but they're struggling to make it happen anyway. The characters that I specifically used were Chalmers and Jackson. They're a criminal investigation division from Mogadishu era when they're taken. And they are investigating a spy that is working for the bad guys, trying to find someone that has been going to report on their troop movements before they can do too much damage.
So working in someone else's universe, it's a little different than when you get to Second Chance Angel, which is something you and Casey developed. What is that? I mean, obviously, there's not as much world building involved. Is there a Bible for all of this that you have to follow, or what do you start with?
So, well, for the 1632 universe, oh my, is there a Bible? There's, as I said, there's at least 2 million words, but the core novels are up to, I think, 1 million or something like that. It's huge, so you don't necessarily have to know all of that, but it helps. And then because I'm an idiot, I shot my mouth off about India and what was going on there. So I had to do an enormous amount of research on India, specifically the Mughal India, which at the time was Islamic, the Islamic conquerors, Hindu soldiers, a very inclusive kind of empire, as far as like they took talent from wherever talent was. And they paid cash, which nobody did at the time. So the creative process in that one, in that universe, is very much constrained by what's come before and by what is plausible given the extensive research that you have to do. So, but every story is a human story, right? Otherwise, we're really not telling it. So in this particular regard, it's within these constraints, try and tell that human story, make it engaging, make it fun, and maybe make some points that you wanted to make as a human being or writer. So that's that universe. And then for Chuck Gannon's universe, I've been lucky enough to be one of his alpha or beta readers for a number of years for the mainline series. So I had read everything that exists as far as it's been published for that, and some that hadn't been published yet. And then I was kind of part of the initial skull sessions that originated the idea of doing this Murphy's Lawless sequence and developing that. So I knew I was very familiar with a lot of the background anyway. And then having read, he prepared a Bible for us that was, I think, 120 some odd pages, as well as a bunch of Pinterest files that to kind of show what the imagery that he thought of the planet that they're on, called Rabac, which was cool. So, and I'm used to, because of my gaming background, I'm very much used to assimilating the Gazette, assimilating the, this is the universe and what's the story you're going to tell in that universe kind of thing.
So how did your planning outlining process look? Is it a detailed outline for you, or how does that work?
Well, for Maneater, not at all. I kind of pantsed it very heavily. It's because it's a novella, it's pretty short, so there wasn't a whole lot I had to do. But for Second Chance Angel and anything that you're going to do collaboratively, you've got to absolutely make certain that you have an outline that you've agreed on, because otherwise things get confusing and there's it, you know, people don't know where you're at, that kind of stuff. So
is that a long drawn out process? The two of you going back and forth and deciding how it's going to be?
Yeah, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a long drawn out process. It's one of the cool things that I was just able to do is that Eric taught me, Eric Flint, was a very easy, very simple outlining technique using Excel or whatever equivalent you need for Sheets or whatever for Apple. And it's the leftmost column is chapter. The second one is scene. The second column is scene. And then it goes who, what, when, where, and why across. And it's just one or two sentences, or it can be as complex as you want it to be. But one or two sentences describing what's going on and the what, the when is really useful for connecting how, you know, what's the time frame for everything, and where and why, again, for making sure you know where you're at in the book and that kind of thing. Really, very useful, especially if when you're like me, you're not necessarily all that up on actual outlining technique as far as Roman numerals and large capital letters and all that kind of stuff. And the biggest thing I found advantageous about it is that if you change something in the writing, you still want to discover something while you're writing, you can just go in and change it. And it doesn't have to affect the huge slew of you know, the numeral system and everything, how you organized it in that very strict outlining kind of sense.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that particular one before. It sounds useful.
Yeah, I found it to be, you know, and most authors that I've spoken to, they're like, wow. Because, you know, if outlining is not intimidating, then cool. But if it is intimidating for you and you feel like, well, that's going to constrain me because I'm not going to be able to do all those, you know, the discovery that I want to do. Well, it's easy to continue to discover something about the characters, et cetera, and then only have to change one or two lines or even change a row in the Excel document so you can kind of keep track of where you you turned left and that kind of thing. So
when you're working in someone else's universe, was there a approval process before you went ahead?
Well, Eric and I collaborated on the outline for Mission to the Moogles very closely. And I basically, yes. That, so the outline is definitely an approval process, and work very closely with him to get that squared away. And then depending on your deal with Eric, as far as how much work he has time for, number one, number two, also thinks he needs to do for it. He'll, you know, either weigh in fully and be doing 50% of the actual writing, or he'll do less, depending on, those criteria. Hmm. And but the outline is always with Eric, a very collaborative process.
What did your actual writing process look like? Are you a fast writer or slow writer? Do you do it, you know, considering what your job is, I would think that you have to work around things a bit.
Well, I think everybody has their strengths and their weaknesses, right? I can write action very, very well. Personal combat, I do pretty damn well. And that part of that springs from 20 years of experience of writing down what somebody did to somebody else in an incident report, sometimes 3 and 4 times a day. So I have lots of practice with doing that, but I am not necessarily as good at giving you an emotional scene, which for me is, it runs counter to my day job experience. You're not supposed to put a bunch of emotion into what you're writing about in an incident report. So it can go really fast and it can go really, really slow. It really depends on how I'm feeling. But as far as like the logistics of it, I was writing, ride a motorcycle in my commute back and forth to work. I kind of started injuring my the tendons in my hand, so typing was miserable. So I started using Dragon dictation, and that worked pretty well. And I would do, you know, whenever I had an opportunity. One of the things about police work in general, as far as being in the field, is you have 10-hour shifts, but you're working four 10s. So you work 4 days and you got a few days off. So I would ignore my responsibilities as a father and a husband and sit down as long as I could and try and crank some pages. I find it a lot easier to write to a contract than I do to write on spec. And which is one of the reasons why Second Chance Angel, I think, really spun out fast for me, because the contract wasn't necessarily for money. It was the contract between Casey and I, as both of us being similarly experienced writers and not wanting to let the other person down on this pet project that we had taken on for ourselves, and that we were taking time out from other things that we might be able to do to work with one another. So it was really important to me, just as a professional, to make sure I didn't let her down. So I, you know, I didn't care. I was going to crank those letters and those words out that day, anytime I had an opportunity to work on Second Chance Angel.
Well, since we're talking about that, and although Casey gave her synopsis of it, somebody might not have heard that episode and they're hearing about it for the first time. So how would you describe Second Chance Angel?
A very noir mystery thriller set in a distant future. With aliens and a lot of heart and a little bit of excitement too. There's quite a bit going on. AIs, alien crime lords, etc. So we touched on a lot of different stones in the subgenres of science fiction.
Did you like alternate chapters or alternate scenes, or decide who's doing which scenes? How was that divided up between you?
It kind of fell naturally to us. I wrote the male muck parts and she wrote the angel parts. The female, that sounds kind of vaguely dirty, doesn't it? Angel parts. she wrote the AI, angel. And, as we closed in on a finish, I started to feel, and Casey as well, we started to feel like there was some difficulty with first off, the first person perspective is a challenge for a full length modern novel today, because people are expecting to have, you know, 100,000, 200,000 words in their inbox for their novel. We were coming in kind of slow on those numbers and were worried that that would be a problem. And then also trying to tell the full story was from the only two perspectives and they share a body was a little bit challenging. So we added in an additional characters that were already in, but we added them as point of view characters. They were AIs that are not sentient. They are sophonts, but they're not sentient. They don't feel at the beginning of the novel. So that was told in third person. And because they were administrative AIs and law enforcement AIs, they had a lot more data collection points to use for their point of view. And that was collaboratively written between the two of us.
Once you have a draft, either for yourself or for the collaborative novel, what did the revision process look like? Did you have beta readers or anything like that? Or how does
Yes, we had. We're both lucky enough that we have a lot of friends that are also writers and voracious readers. And I sent out, there's a group of guys and gals that I have been from World Fantasy, mostly, that I've been associated with for some time. We call ourselves the Breakfast Squad. We just, we basically hang out, drink too much and make bad jokes in the mornings after. So we get everybody up and at breakfast, we make inappropriate humor our métier. So we had, I sent it out to them and all of them came back with positive for the most part. And they had a couple of things they found problematic and we fixed those problematic issues and turned around and I did principal editing first pass. And then I think Casey went through again. And then we sent it off to a publisher. That publisher turned us down. And we then went to our agent, Justin Bell at Spectrum Literary. And he turned around and shopped it about.
And it's being published by?
Blackstone Publishing is who eventually picked it up. And they've put it out there and it's already out and swimming with the other fishes.
And the Murphy's Law list, I presume, since it's Kane Riordan, is it Bain that publishes that?
No, actually. There's only so much room in any publisher's house for different stuff. And Chuck was looking around for places that he could put additional content for the Kane Riordan universe and contacted Chris Kennedy Publishing. Mm-hmm. And they worked out a deal, and again, and with Tony Weisskopf, the publisher at and editor at Bain Books, they worked out a deal. It's like, yeah, cool, no problem. Go ahead and take this portion of the universe and play. So, and Chris Kennedy Publications did an imprint called Beyond Terra Books, and that's what has published the Murphy's Lawless series. So far it's only in one season, but we're in the process now working on the second season, and a third season is planned, as well as Lost Signals, which is an anthology of mostly short stories, but it seems like every one of us went over the limit on the words. That was initially kickstarted and then produced, is going to be republished with Beyond Terra Press. So we're excited about that too.
What was the editorial process like for each of these books once it ended up at the publisher? What sorts of feedback did you get?
So it's been very different depending on who it was with. So Eric is, he's such an old hand with the editing of his work with co-authors. He generally tends to edit a lot of stuff up front and then submit it to Tony and Bain, and they have a copy editor go through it. But it seemed to me that it was harder to pass Eric for editing than it was to actually pass through to the Bain folks, because they have a high degree of trust with him that he is going to furnish good copy and complete copy. When it came to the Murphy's Lawless, sent it to Chuck, and then he sent it on once he was done editing it. And there were some challenges with the Maneater copy because I was going through, I had back surgery recently and stuff like that, and was changing some of my medications, et cetera. So I was not as focused as I would have liked to have been while I was writing that. Although I do think it turned out really nicely. And Chuck had some editing to do with it, and then gave it over to, I may be mispronouncing it, but Mia Cleave at the Beyond Terra imprint, Chris Kennedy Publishing. And they turned around and got it out there real quick. With Second Chance Angel, they hired Blackstone Publishing. When I say they, Blackstone Publishing hires some freelancer editors, and they hired Betsy Mitchell. It was a huge, like, wow, really? We were super excited that was how it turned out. And she was just really great to work with. She made it a much, much better book with her work.
Well, as editors, good editors do. That's kind of what they're all about. Yes.
And I, you know, it was really, really neat. It was neat working with her because she taught us a lot about how we had simple changes in some of the things that we were doing would lead to much better throughput. As far as understanding it, what was going on, because it is a pretty complex novel too.
And it has some nice reviews I see on your website. So you must have been pleased, Publishers Weekly. And well, yeah. Eric Flint gave you a good review. And David Drake, you mentioned Hammer Slammers, and there you have a review from David Drake.
Yeah. I get choked up when I even think about that because, he's my idol.
Yeah, it's one of the great things about this field is that we all get started and we read people that inspire us. And then next thing you know, you're at World Fantasy or somewhere like that, and you're actually meeting these people that were kind of far off, distant figures. And you find out they're real people that you can actually.
They don't have clay feet necessarily. Yeah, they don't necessarily have clay feet either. So, yeah, Dave was – I didn't really – I think I read – a couple of books by him, Hammer Slammers beforehand, but I got into one of the anthologies when I was living in Switzerland. And, we moved there in the summer, so school hadn't started. So I had, zero friends for the most part, although there were one or two that I ended up meeting before school started. But I had a lot of time on my hands and went down to the English language media store, which is called Elm Books, the anagram of their name. And I picked up, I think, The War World, and I can't remember the name of it now. I just wrote about it the other day, but by David Drake. And, to have him, so he was my buddy. He was writing stuff that I really wanted to read, and he was my buddy in my mind as far as narrating life. So it was really huge for me to eventually meet him again through World Fantasy and Borderlands Books. I ended up driving him around San Francisco to look at the Diego Rivera murals and that kind of stuff, and just kind of hanging out and being careful not to tell him that, oh, I just love your work. We're descending into that kind of... And it's really hard when a stranger comes up to you and says, I love you. So you don't want to go there as a fan. So no. I managed to keep my fanboy in check, and we've been buddies ever since. It's been a real pleasure. And when I, with great temerity and worried about it, I when I wrote him to ask him to read it, he not only read it, but he enjoyed it and offered to blurb it. So huge deal.
Yeah. You talked about all the places you've lived, and of course you've done lots of things, and then a police officer for the last 20 years. You did mention how the working as a police officer has perhaps influenced things a bit. Do you feel that all that experience, that living experience you have, has made you a stronger writer?
Yeah. There's no doubt in my mind that, the part of the reason why I joined the department, it wasn't just for a regular paycheck, but also, you know, I wanted to have some stories. Experience informs everybody's work. You can be a great writer and tell some really cool tales as a youngster, but I think that there is a lot to be said for experience, life experience, and how you process that, those experiences can inform your work quite a bit. Certainly for me, I don't think I had anywhere near the talent to be able to compensate for my lack of experience when I started.
Do you feel you're improving all the time?
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. If you stop learning, you're failing. I feel like it's everything can teach you quite a bit. And part of the cool thing about collaborative work too, is that you can learn from your co-authors immensely if you have an open ear to do so.
Are you very different as writers, the two of you?
I think that Casey is magnificent at emotionally impactful scenes. I am much less so. So I really picked up a few things from her as far as that. And then, oftentimes when guys try and write romance, it ends up just being a little bit like porn. And I think that, or most guys, one of the things I learned from her is that there's a strong vein of romance in this. And, I think it, I learned quite a bit about how to portray that without being, physical, being so utterly reliant on physical description.
Well, we're getting about 10 minutes left here. So we'll take the big philosophical questions. Why do you do it? why do you write? Why do you think anybody writes? And why write science fiction and fantasy type stuff specifically?
Number one is the lifelong love affair with the genre. It is the ultimate in anything's possible. If you can imagine it and make it plausible, you can make it possible in your work. So that is really cool and unmatched, I think, in any other genre. With regard to why I write, I am a lot healthier when I'm writing and getting my mad out on the page rather than in my interpersonal relationships with others. One of the things about my profession, especially in recent years and this last year, is that we are expected to be held to a standard that is very, very difficult to adhere to, first off. And secondly, it is extremely difficult when you do adhere to it to not appear as if you're doing otherwise, because the ignorant or those that are only partially educated in what it is we do will often see something, and violence looks like violence. It looks bad. People don't go beyond the appearance of things very much in this day and age of the feels to understand that the legal justifications and the legal situation that these officers often find themselves in is difficult, and it does not have the benefit of armchair quarterbacking or hindsight. It has to be done right now in this moment. So one of the things that that writing allows me to do is to kind of explain that and to work out some of my own feelings about situations that I've been in and difficulties that I've had on the job and personally.
And why do you think we write, any of us write? What do you think is this impulse to tell stories?
Well, I think it's one of the ways we relate things that work and things that don't. And it's also one of the ways that, Dave's a good example too. Dave always talks about getting his mad out and, coming back from Vietnam and not being able to talk about it. And some people find avenues to talk about it through speaking to other veterans or speaking to other people in whatever workplace that they have, or, you know, support groups, that kind of thing. And some people need to write about it and they need to explore their perspectives that the voices in their own heads are telling them they need to talk to or talk about these things. So I think it's always a good thing that, you know, storytellers are how we communicate knowledge about the world and how we think it works. And for the storyteller themselves, it's often a good way to get to process feelings that are otherwise troublesome.
Well, the podcast is called The World Shapers, and I always say it's a little grand to think of any story as particularly shaping the entire world, but certainly stories can shape individual readers. So when you're writing, do you have any hope that for how it might affect your readers? Is there, you know, when they come away from your stories, what do you hope they take with them?
Well, this particular one, The Second Chance Angel, is very important to me, that people realize that trauma and dealing with trauma is, there are a number of different ways to handle it. And you can be a highly successful individual handling it, processing it and getting it, you know, working on it rather than suppressing it or not trying to think about it, those kind of things. There's a lot of different ways to deal with, to effectively deal with trauma and issues that arise from trauma that include rather than preclude you doing well in your profession and in your relationships with others. So if there's anything that I would like people to kind of get is that there's other people going through the same stuff that need to process it, and that there are other people out there in the world that will listen.
And at the same time, I presume you're hoping to entertain?
Yes. That it really, you know, most people are going to look at this and they're going to go, really? I mean, there's like, there's a singer on the cover and squiggly alien heads and stuff like that. This guy's reaching pretty far, but yes, the ultimate and primary goal is to tell a good story. And along the way, I would like for people to gather or take from it that there's a lot of ways to heal thyself. And they usually include actually tackling the problem head on, and they do not preclude getting better at your profession.
What are you working on next?
So Casey and I just finished the outline and first couple of chapters for The Third Sin, which is the sequel to Second Chance Angel, which has a couple of references there to both the noir genre and a certain robot AI famous guy's work, certain laws of robotics. We're excited to be beginning work on that. I have been working on an epic fantasy for 12 years now. So I'm trying to close in on the finish of that. But I'm also rehabbing from my back injury and trying to get back to work, et cetera. So there's quite a bit of stuff going on that's slowing me down a little bit. But we're also doing that second season of Murphy's Lawless, and I'm hoping to have a story in that. I've got a bunch of short fiction that has come out in the last year. I'm hoping to get more opportunities to write short stories as well. So there's a lot of different openings.
Is the Second Chance Angel foreseen as a trilogy or an endless series, or what's the idea there?
Yeah, there's no, that was one of the things that is kind of important to note too, is that one of the things that Jim Bain, the original and the man that built Bain Books, one of the things he said to Eric Flint, as related to me by Eric, is that the best way to not have a series is to try and write your first novel in that series as if you have a series. So write a complete story, write a complete novel that indicates that, you know, that it's discreet and the reader goes away happy. So we tried to do that with Second Chance Angel. I think we accomplished it. But we are wide open. We did a lot of world building in Second Chance Angel, and there's a lot of mystery left to, for both Angel and Muck to, unravel, and fight and, suffer through. So we are very hopeful that we're going to be able to do a long-running series with it, as long as the readers are willing to buy it and publishers are willing to publish it. We have no specific thing about, like, it's going to be a five-story arc or a five-novel arc, that kind of thing. But we have the next one outlined, as I said, and we have a preface for the third one, which is tentatively titled The First Question, because we like to mess with people's numbering systems.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. The first one is Second yeah. Chance Angle. The third one is, no, the second one is Third Sin, and then the fourth. Then you
the third one is going to be The First Question. And the fourth, I don't know. We're going to have to get creative on that one.
Use a fraction.
Four score. Yeah. Four score or something like that. But yeah, we had a lot of fun, and we hope that people really enjoy it. It's my favorite work, I think, so far, because I really got to, with Casey, she and I basically just sat down and we built a universe. Whereas with everything else I've done in the past collaboratively, it was done. I was the guy, the journeyman coming into the Masters arena. So this was really cool to be masters of our own universe, to be able to just kind of go, this is really cool to me, and then hash it out between the two of us as equals, rather than as one of us being previously established and the holder of the IP.
And where can people find you and more about the book online?
So griffinbarber.com and on Facebook as Griffin Barber, and Twitter as The Ranting Griffin and as Griffin Barber as well. Baldy Locks is one of the nicknames I'm going with now, because I am bald. Accessible anytime to chat about stuff. I really enjoyed this. So I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to come on the show and talk about world building.
Well, you were recommended to me by Dave Butler at Bing Books, who's been on the show and whom I met at a convention. So,
yes. Yeah. He's a great guy. I met him too.
One of the few authors I can truly say I looked up to, because I'm 6'2" and he's more than that. So
yeah, he is. Yep. He's a great guy too. He's been really neat to get to know.
Yeah, I've enjoyed getting to know him a little bit myself. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the podcast. So thanks so much for being on. I enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
I did.
All right. Well, bye for now.
Bye for now.
So thanks again to Griffin Barber for that great interview. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we both did. Just a reminder that you can find the World Shapers podcast online at theworldshapers.com. There's a complete archive there of all of the past episodes, transcripts of almost everything. There's a full transcript of all except a few episodes, which I haven't managed to get around to doing yet when I was pressed for time. But in general, there are full transcripts of everybody. Also, a reminder that the World Shapers is on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can buy autographed books directly from me at edwardwillettshop.com. You can also download some of my books there in ebook form. My publishing company, again, is shadowpawpress.com, and want to remind you once more of the Shapers of Worlds anthology featuring a mixture of original fiction and reprints from the first year guests of the podcast. Some really big names in there, so please check that out. You can get it directly from shadowpawpress.com, or you can buy it wherever you buy your ebooks. It's on all of the major outlets for ebooks. You can find me also on Twitter at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T, on Facebook at edward.willett, and on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor, because I missed that memo about always using the same handle on all of your social media accounts. And I hope you will continue to come back for future episodes of The World Shaper. Among the guests coming up in very short order are James Morrow, F. Paul Wilson, and Cory Doctorow. So that's pretty exciting. And I'm working on others for after that. So I do hope that you will come back. And a final reminder that The World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks again for listening in, and I hope you'll come back many times over to hear more interviews with the people who create the worlds in which we've had so many fantastic adventures alongside the characters they create that bring those worlds to life. That's it for this time. Bye for now.